Subway has teamed up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for $5 to participating Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See store for details. Subway. Eat fresh.
Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. I'm getting criticized for too much soccer talk lately. So you know what? Let's do a mega NFL podcast for old time's sake. We're going to have Aaron Schatz from footballoutsiders.com. New book coming out. He's going to be on for the first 45 minutes. And then right around the 45-minute mark, from the National Football Post, Mike Lombardi. And he is going to talk about his blue chip project that we actually spawned on our last podcast together. A lot of NFL talk coming up. And first, on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, from footballoutsiders.com, the creator of that, as well as the editor of the Football Outsiders Almanac 2009, available on Amazon.com and footballoutsiders.com, our old friend, Mr. Aaron Schatz. What's happening?
Hey, I'm doing well, man. I am ready for the season to start, too.
Do you have any stats that explain why the season is starting so late this year?
I think it just has to do with Labor Day and being really late and how that all works. I don't know why.
It's the end of August. I'm ready for football.
The Super Bowl is, what, March 12th or something?
Yeah. It goes head-to-head against week one of March Madness.
Wait till we get to that 18-week season, man. Woo! Super Bowl's going to be in April.
Well, it should just start the first weekend of September. I think we should all agree. Maybe this is the kind of stuff we should be able to vote on during the presidential election, when the football season should start. I would want to vote on that.
Well,
you know, 13 days into September, and I haven't seen the Patriots yet. That's just weird.
The way is that this is they're doing the weekend after Labor Day weekend. They don't want to start on Labor Day weekend because TV viewership is down. So they're doing the week after that. So because Labor Day weekend is so late, NFL is so late. So there's your explanation.
There you go. I knew you'd come through for me. Let's talk about the season. Now, have you come off this Rams thing a little bit in your book? All the signs are pointing to the Rams as a mega sleeper. And please tell me you've come off this.
Well, I mean, I still think that they're a sleeper possibility. The trick is, the thing is that I don't think that we're not predicting that they're going to be a very good team. We're predicting that there's a good chance of them being a good team. In other words, compared to every year, some team that's been losing for a couple of years shows up out of nowhere, right? Last year it was Atlanta. The year before it was Cleveland.
Yep.
What we're saying is that of all those teams, I went specifically this year looking for trends that identified those teams. And when you look for those trends, they point to the Rams as the team of all the, like, losers of the last couple of years that's most likely to put it together this year, more than the Buffalo Bills or San Francisco or Oakland or Kansas City.
This is my favorite game with the NFL season.
Right.
And I always spend way too many words trying to figure out who that team is because it's always from that same group. It's usually like between 7 and 9 teams. They all suck. Everybody writes them off going into the season, just assumes they're going to suck. And at least one of those teams always wins 10 games.
Right. So I'm not saying that the Rams are automatically going to, you know, threaten the Patriots and Steelers and Colts for NFL supremacy. But I think that there is a reasonable chance of them having a miracle season. Look, they could put it all together with massive improvement and still go 7-9. That's how bad they were last year.
Right.
And well, the fact is, things could not work out for them, and they could go 4-12. When we run the season 10,000 times, that's how we simulate things to get the win projections in the book. They had the biggest swing between their best seasons and their worst seasons.
Huh.
So they had some seasons where they really put it together and suddenly turned into like the 98 Falcons, and they had other years where they just went 4-12. So, I mean, I think there's a wide range of possibilities, but the fact is this is a team, the Rams, on offense, has been unbelievably unhealthy the last couple of years, unbelievably bad in the red zone last year, and there's just a great trend of teams that take offensive linemen in the first dozen picks of the draft improving on offense significantly, like, for example, last year's Broncos and Dolphins.
And also the new coach factor.
I like Spagnuolo. That's a subjective. The fact is that objectively, new coach normally means a little bit of a step backwards because it takes time for teams to learn the new systems. But I like, subjectively, I like Spagnuolo as a head coach candidate. And I also like, particularly because his strength is the front seven, and that the Rams have, you know, used a lot of draft value on front seven players over the last couple of years, starting with Chris Long. So I think it's a really good fit.
But wouldn't recent history suggest that actually every year one team that has a new coach makes a jump? Like, I'm thinking like Sean Payton last year, John Harbaugh.
Right, but most of them don't.
Most of them don't, but sometimes.
For every, you know, John Harbaugh, there's an Art Shell return, so. There's a late, you know, for every Sean Payton, there's a Lane Kiffin, so.
But when you think about it, if you go from a really bad coach to a competent coach, it's kind of hard to measure how many wins that's worth. Because, like, for instance, I keep looking at Kansas City, who I would have just absolutely been all over as a sleeper if they had made that Gonzalez trade. And I'm still kind of trying to talk myself into it. But you go from Herm Edwards to really anybody who's competent, and how many wins is that worth? That could be worth 5 wins.
Well, part of the problem is that we just have so far had a hard time trying to come up with ways to mathematically measure the quality of coaches. I mean, we can subjectively measure that we think certain coaches are better than other coaches, but it's hard to identify that certain things are coaching rather than just random chance or injuries or player chemistry or whatever. And as far as Herm goes, you know, I do think the guy gets a little bit of a bad rap. He's not a terrible coach. He's just a coach with some very specific strengths and weaknesses, and I think he'd be awesome if he could take a college job.
I agree.
He's built for college, like Pete Carroll. He just was in the wrong league.
Yeah. Well, how about this? I think this is where you could make the most ground over this next 2 years. If you could really come up with a way to quantify how much a coach either screws up a team or holds the fort or makes it better. And here's my idea. I think you just study everything Brad Childress does this year. You learn all the lessons from him for 16 straight weeks, and somehow some sort of formula will emerge. Because he's probably the worst head coach in the league right now.
If Brad Childress doesn't make it as a head coach, if things don't work out for the Vikings, he has a future as a comedian.
Or something.
I was at the Paul Zimmerman benefit that Peter King had in Jersey, and Brad Childress sent this video along that was so funny that I was like, this guy's in the wrong job.
Well, I would have come to that conclusion anyway, but I think you just reinforced it. I think, let's talk about the Vikings for a second, because this is really the perfect storm to me. You have high expectations. You have Favre, who is a turnover machine. You have Adrian Peterson, who is also kind of secretly a turnover machine. And you have a coach who makes a ton of mistakes. This feels to me like this could be one of those teams that could really break your system. All the signs will point to them that they should have gone 15-1, but they'll actually go 6-10.
He fumbled a lot last year, Peterson did, but the fact is that's not necessarily going to carry over from year to year. I mean, there are some guys who definitely fumble more than other guys, but, you know, the extreme of whatever he had last year, 8 fumbles, that's not likely to happen again. The thing is, you know, they turn the ball over, that just puts that awesome defensive line back on the field. I guess the trick is they can't turn the ball over so often that defensive line gets tired, and by the end of the, you know, game, you know, Pat Williams is sucking wind.
Right.
That would be a little bit of a problem. But
I think Peterson's a little careless with the ball, personally.
Some guys are more careless than others. Wasn't one of the things of him coming out of college the question of whether he ran a little too straight up and down, I guess?
Yeah.
But he does put his shoulder into guys. He's not going to have 8 fumbles again. I mean, he's not. I don't think he's going to have 0 all of a sudden. But I don't think he's going to have 8.
but we could say that Favre is probably going to have over 15 interceptions.
I'm pretty sure Favre will have over 15.
Yeah, assuming he stays healthy.
Which, I mean, you know, everybody assumes because he's Brett Favre and, you know, he always has. But the fact is there's only one quarterback in history that's ever had a good season over the age of 40.
And who is that?
And that's Warren Moon.
Oh. But Kurt Warner turns 40 this year.
Isn't he 38?
Or he is 40.
He's 2 years younger.
No, he's 38. You're right. He feels like he should be 40.
And listen, I mean, that's one of the reasons why our projection for the Cardinals is down. The fact is that the quarterbacks of that age just don't have hugely successful seasons. Most Hall of Famers are retired by that point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with Favre, it's people have said, you know, is it, does the Favre return improve your Vikings projection? And the answer is yeah, by like maybe 0.2 of a win. I mean, most of our projection for the Vikings as being a playoff team is based on the defense, especially the defensive line and the running game. It's not based on the quarterback. We had projected Tavares Jackson to have a reasonable year because we thought, figured, you know, the rest of that team would kind of just drag the quarterback along. You know, good offensive line, good running game. The other defense is always going to have to put 8 in the box. You know, the quarterback has to be reasonable, or at least put up reasonable numbers. So Favre doesn't change that. You know, if that team wins or loses, it'll probably still be based on the defensive line.
You created a new stat in your book this year called Adjusted Games Lost, which measures injuries and whether a team suffered an inordinate amount of injuries or not. And you came to the conclusion that the Seahawks last year had a historic injury run.
Yes, I should give credit where credit is due. Actually, Bill Barnwell is the one who came up with Adjusted Games Lost, and we actually premiered in last year's book, but this year we actually listed it for every team and like really got into it.
Yeah, because I hadn't remembered seeing that.
We may have called it something else in last year's book, but now we have a nice acronym. And once you have a nice name for something, it's much more memorable.
You know I love acronyms.
Yeah. Agle is not quite pronounceable, but Agle probably is the sound most Seahawks fans made when Walter Jones went down again in the preseason. So
you know, the sleeper is going to come out of one of the West divisions, in my opinion, just because we really only have two. We have one sure thing, San Diego, and one, you know, reasonably good team in Arizona.
Which our projections don't even think are going to be reasonably good.
In one of those two divisions, somebody is going to win 10 games, and we're going to be like, oh, my God, I can't believe they won 10 games. So who would you say out of those two
divisions? I think it's going to be Seattle or St. Louis.
Not AFC. You're staying away from
no,
AFC.
No, listen, I mean, Kansas City, you have the possibility. But like you said, the Tony Gonzalez trade is weird. It's like a year late. The trading Tony Gonzalez to rebuild would have made a lot more sense a year ago. Now they've kind of started to put it together, the young talent beginning to coalesce. This would have been a year where he would have been more useful to them. And I guess I just don't quite see it. I think Pioli's more about building slowly.
Yeah.
I could definitely see the Chiefs as a 2010 team. Oakland is still a joke, and I think Denver's just a mess right now.
Yeah, that Orton thing has not started off well. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that.
And the Brandon Marshall situation is not good either because they're trapped because they can't trade him because they can't show that anybody can beg their way out of town.
Well, and also he's a psychopath. That's on him.
So I prefer the word immature.
Okay.
So I definitely think it's going to come out of the NFC West. If our projections are right about Arizona declining in particular, then it'll come out of the NFC West, and I think it'll be Seattle or St. Louis. Probably Seattle, despite these injuries they've had early on.
You know what I hated about the Gonzalez trade? Not just that KC basically said, we're going to go for it in 2010. I just don't think you can do that in football. Too much changes from year to year, and they had a nice nucleus in place, I felt like, and they had, you know, a lot of high picks, and last year they weren't as bad as it seemed like they were, you know what I mean?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I just think they did it a year too late because they had a nice nucleus, but that nucleus was a year younger last year and definitely was not ready. In 2008, that nucleus was absolutely not ready.
Yeah, but
that was the year they didn't need Tony Gonzalez.
Yeah,
this
but
year, those guys are starting to put it together. Tony Gonzalez would have been useful.
But look at the situation last year. You had a GM and a coach who were in a must-win year. They're not going to trade Tony Gonzalez.
Right, but anybody who thought that they were going to win, come on, with all those rookies and with, you know, Tyler Thigpen at quarterback and the two rookie corners.
Yeah, but how many times have we seen a front office or a coach screw a fan base over because they're trying to win right now, even though that's not the right thing to do?
100,000?
Yeah. The other thing I didn't like about that trade is I don't feel like Atlanta was a good fit. And then you had a stat in your book about like they were like 31st and throwing to the tight end. Just seemed like a weird team for him to go to.
They were 31st and throwing to the tight end. That will not continue this year.
But they had decent tight ends last year.
You do a lot. Wait, what'd you say?
Didn't they have decent tight ends last year or no?
Oh, no. It was like Ben Hartsock and
Justin
Peel.
Maybe that explains it.
You know, Peel's more of a blocker. And, you know, they might split him out. Listen, the second half of the year when they were running the pistol in Kansas City, Gonzalez was almost entirely a wide receiver. And I don't mean a slot guy. I mean wide receiver. I mean out by, like, the sidelines. So, I mean, maybe Atlanta will do that a little bit. And the Gonzalez thing kind of screws up our projections a little bit because no team in history has ever traded for the best tight end ever before. So there really isn't, you know, a historical similar team to guide ourselves by.
What do you see with that NFC South? Seems like the weirdest division to me.
I feel like all four teams are going to go 8-8. Nah, that's not true. I don't think Tampa will go 8-8. I think Tampa will be better than people expect.
Me too.
I think people expect them to be like 3-13, and I think they're going to go more like 7-9.
Right.
But I honestly could see New Orleans, Atlanta, or Carolina winning it. Our numbers like Carolina by a little bit, but sort of expect their offense to decline. Jake Delhomme, our numbers are really down on Delhomme this year, which, you know, in turn drags the running game down just because if the offense is on the field less because the passing game isn't doing as well, then D'Angelo Williams can't run for 9,000 bazillion yards.
Your numbers are down on Delhomme, and so is every Panther fan after his playoff performance.
No kidding. No kidding. So, I mean, their defense is still – there's still a lot of strong reasons to believe in the defense, but you could definitely have another worst to first there with the Saints. And Atlanta could definitely, you know, the fact is that teams that improve significantly from one year to the next, the way Atlanta and Miami did, normally fall back to earth the next year.
Yes.
The only real exception were the Parcells Jets. Atlanta could be the second big exception to that rule because, you know, Gonzalez, there's really no way to understand what kind of impact Gonzalez will have. And because Matt Ryan had the best rookie season of any quarterback in like the last 40 years, and we don't know what will happen to him as a sophomore. But more likely, I think they'll fall back to the pack a little bit and go 8-8. And I feel like the whole division is just going to go 8-8.
And you didn't even mention the Michael Turner curse of 370.
I did not mention Michael Turner and the curse of 370, partly because I love Jarius Norwood so much that even if Michael Turner broke his knee, I would feel like the running game would be fine. But, yes, I have spent another preseason trying to explain to everybody that, no, we don't have anything against Michael Turner. And, yes, we understand that people believe that for this reason or that reason or the other reason that Turner can defy the curse and that maybe he can. It's possible that he will not decline this year because of last year's immense workload. But, you know, there are always possible exceptions, but nothing that people are saying about Turner is any different from what they said about Larry Johnson, what they said about Sean Alexander, what they said about Jamal Lewis, what they said about Curtis Martin. I mean, you know, we've been through this every year. So
you know,
I wouldn't take the risk of drafting Michael Turner in my fantasy league.
You know why I know that theory is working? Because there's been like a backlash this year.
Oh, yeah.
People writing, like, people saying,
It's by far probably the best known of the Football Outsiders theories and the one that coaches and players actually comment on.
I like it. But, I mean, it is an interesting point. Who is the guy who's seven carries shy? Adrian Peterson?
Right.
363 last year. So the argument is, well, why does seven carries make a difference for him?
And the answer is that it does make a difference. There's worry about Peterson, sure. But, there's always kind of injury worry about Peterson. And if Peterson were to just decline a bit, he'd still be a pretty good back. Whereas if Turner were to decline a bit, you know, if you look at him on a per-play basis last year, Turner was really average, considering that he played a pretty easy slate of defenses. Most of his value was just getting the ball a lot, in particular getting the ball a lot in the red zone. So if he decline, he doesn't go from you know, spectacular to really good the way Peterson does. He goes from good to average or good to below average. I think there's also a little more faith that Minnesota could split carries if they needed. I don't know. They seem to have more faith in Taylor than Atlanta does in Norwood, even though we love Norwood. So.
Peterson is the clear number one. Wait, D'Angelo Williams.
No, we disagree, actually.
What do you mean?
Our numbers have the best fantasy back this year as Maurice Jones-Drew.
Because he's going to get every carry?
Because unlike Peterson, Maurice Jones-Drew gets receiving numbers.
Oh.
We have Peterson leading the league in rushing. But if you are in a standard league that also counts receiving, you know, 10 yards receiving and receiving touchdowns, then we have Maurice Jones-Drew number one with Peterson and Forte 2 and 3.
That sounds fine, but I have the number one pick of my West Coast League, and I'm still going to take Adrian Peterson.
And I do not begrudge you that decision.
Thank you.
This is a great year. As far as I'm concerned, this would be a great year to pick second or third.
I agree. I would even not be unhappy with fourth because of this crazy D'Angelo Williams resurgence. What do you guys see for him this year?
We have him ranked sixth right now. I have Steven Jackson fourth, but I think part of it sort of depends on how you feel about Jonathan Stewart.
How
it really depends what percentage of carries Williams gets, and part of that, and a large part of that, depends on Stewart's health. I don't doubt Williams' talent or the talent of that offensive line. I doubt the split of carries, and I doubt the quarterback.
Let's move into the speed round. I'm going to throw some names at you. You just tell me quickly what you think. Brian Westbrook.
In danger of having his career end if he has another injury.
So you would not take him in the top two rounds?
Maybe the end of the second round.
Clinton Portis.
You know, good second or third for fantasy round back.
You still think he has his fastball?
Or close to his fastball. He's not one of the top 10 guys.
Carson Palmer.
Desperately needs the offensive line from 2005 to get in a time machine and show up tomorrow.
Terrell Owens.
Going to bring more media than wins to Buffalo. Old. Not what it used to be.
Mr. Chad Ochocinco.
Probably be better numbers this year just because he's the clear number one receiver.
I kind of like Chad this year.
I love that kickoff.
It was great. I feel that
51
like
yards is good.
Really good. It seems like he's got his mojo back a little bit.
He didn't have his mojo last year. I agree that he has his mojo back. And so even if you have a little natural decline from aging, he's the clear number one guy there. He could also use that offensive line from 2005, though.
Sleeper tight end, Owen Daniels? I guess he's not a sleeper.
Oh, I like Owen Daniels, but my sleeper tight ends are Zach Miller, who's like the only guy who can catch the ball in Oakland.
Yeah.
And Randy McMichael, because of our overall St. Louis offensive improvement theory, combined with the fact that the only clearly, you know, defined receiver there is Donnie Avery.
Best QB that nobody considers a best QB.
Phillip Rivers.
You don't think Phil gets the accolades?
Oh, my God,
you should have
heard this argument I had with some Pittsburgh radio host about who was better, Ben Roethlisberger or Phillip Rivers.
Ooh. I thought you were going to say David Girard.
Oh, I like Girard. Matt Schaub would be a good pick, actually.
If he can stay healthy.
Matt Schaub puts up great numbers, except that he constantly gets injured. And speaking of guys who put up great numbers but constantly get injured, Chad Pennington.
Yes.
There is no way Chad Pennington and Ronnie Brown both make it through the year healthy. No way.
Is there a fantasy defense that you think, given the schedule and the guys coming back and the numbers from last year, that you think could separate itself from all the other defenses?
San Diego and Chicago and Baltimore.
San Diego, Chicago, and Baltimore. Interesting.
Well, I mean, no team really, you know, whichever defense in fantasy separates itself is the team that sort of stumbles its way, luckily, to some extra touchdowns.
Yeah.
But we have the Bears as the top defense in fantasy because we see them improving the pass rush, bouncing back a bit, and then, you know, a fairly easy schedule. Two games against the Lions, two games against the Favre turnover machine.
This is a good segue because I love the Bears. They are 16-1 to win the Super Bowl right now.
The Bears are the number one projected team in our projections in the NFC. Although, if you put my feet to the fire, I would pick the Giants to win the NFC in the playoffs.
Interesting.
But the Bears have the highest win projection.
You have to
understand that whichever team has the highest win projection is not necessarily the team that would have the best DVOA rating in our advanced stats or necessarily the team I would pick for the Super Bowl. But the Bears are projected pretty high.
But it's a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I can't pick the Chargers. No matter how much our numbers love them, I just can't believe North Turner can win three straight playoff games.
We'll talk about that because a lot of people don't know. Your system loves the Chargers.
More than it loved the 2007 Patriots.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. Like, I blinked a couple times every time I ran the numbers.
Well,
like,
what are the reasons?
Going down.
What are the reasons?
It was the best offense in the league last year. Passing game was good in literally every way, except throwing to the tight end where it was average, and that'll probably be better this year. Hmm. They had no weaknesses. In particular, they were kind of average in every other way, except for special teams. And then the defense is going to get much better with Merriman back healthy, Antonio Cromartie no longer having a broken hip.
Right.
So we see them as basically having last year's offense combined with the defense of 2 years ago, and unfortunately the coach is still North Turner.
See, this is what I hate, though, about when you say, like, the great offense and all that. They played six games in an awful division.
I know, we controlled, but this is even after controlling for that.
Really?
Oh, yeah, as easy as their schedule was, it was nothing compared to the easy schedules that the AFC East teams played last year.
Yeah.
Because the AFC East teams had bad, all pretty much had bad defenses, and they played the two Western divisions, which had bad defenses. I mean, bad passing defenses in particular. So, I mean, the numbers for the AFC East quarterbacks last year are completely juiced, which is one of the reasons why Favre may not be quite having the, you know, even the year in Minnesota that he had with the Jets last year, or Castle in Kansas City compared to last year, same thing.
Let's talk about the Pats.
I think the Pats have the second highest projection in our numbers, or third. I can't remember if they're higher than the Colts or not. The two are close.
So when you're doing your projections for that, do you just put in 2007 Brady? How do you figure that out?
I put in a player who was halfway between the 2007 Brady and the 2008 Castle.
Interesting. So Brassel.
Sort of, yeah.
Tat Brassel.
But the defense has to get better than it was last year.
Well, I mean, just look at what's happened to the linebackers, that alone.
I believe, yeah, they no longer are average 96 years of age, so...
I mean, we actually might be able to chase down a running back who runs lower than a 4.640.
Yeah,
that'll be exciting.
Bruschi is in my mat, you know, is mad as a starter. I'm like, no. Bruschi's a situational player this year. Get him off. Anyway.
Let's hope the situation is wearing a headset.
I understand that people might feel that I'm showing my Patriots fandom by saying this. My pick for the Super Bowl would be the Patriots because the three teams that are best in our projections are the Patriots, the Colts, and the Chargers. A coach I don't trust and a coach I don't know versus a coach with three rings.
And we've talked about this. I could swear we've
I don't want to diss Jim Caldwell.
Well, yeah,
I just don't know Jim Caldwell.
But with Norv, I mean, really, there are effects in that third season when you have a bad coach. If somebody's taking over a regime that was competent, the first season, there's really no effect unless you're just an abomination. Second season, you see slight effects. And third season is where the bad habits set in.
Well, the Almanac and the Football Outsiders Almanac in the San Diego chapter, we go over a little bit more what we went over when he was hired 2 years ago. Historically, he has a ridiculously bad record when it comes to blowing leads in the fourth quarter. And he did it again last year.
Yeah.
They repeatedly blew fourth quarter leads last year. This is like a North Turner. All of North Turner's teams do this. Okay, So there is mathematical evidence that he is not a good head coach. And I just cannot believe he will beat Mike Tomlin and or Bill Belichick and or Jeff Fisher, you know, come playoff time. So, you know, our numbers really like the Colts, but... again, I don't know the coach. We don't know what the new coaching staff will do, although I'm sure they'll still win plenty of games because they still have Peyton Manning. So I picked the Patriots, but just because our projections for those three AFC teams are higher than they are for the Bears and the Giants. But, I mean, honestly, we could see a replay of 2 years ago, except that this time we won't go into the Super Bowl thinking that the Patriots are almost assured of winning. So
can we say that the NFC seems like it's a little more stacked than the AFC?
Last year, the NFC definitely came back to the level of the AFC and perhaps surpassed it for the first time in quite some time.
And what about this year? What are you thinking?
I think they're probably equal.
Really? I feel like the NFC
Western
is a little
divisions,
better.
Both Western divisions are still lame, and the NFC South is still like a big muck of 8-8. Nothing compares to the AFC South.
Houston yeah, that's
would be
true.
A serious contender in a lot of other divisions.
What do you see about Jacksonville? Because they seem like they're the most confusing
Our numbers
team.
Think they're going to bounce back heavily. Hmm. I have my subjective questions about the defense.
I would throw in the coach.
But this is another team that had a ton of injuries last year on the offensive line, and it can't possibly be that bad again. And the wide receivers have to be better than they were last year. And Garrard had great numbers last year if you consider how many passes were dropped and how bad and injured the offensive line was.
Yeah. I still worry. The coach seemed like he lost the locker room last year. Usually that
doesn't It seems weird. I don't know what to think about Del Rio because, on the other hand, the fact is that 2 years ago he made by far the right decision with the most impact that most any coach has made over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the most high-profile coaching decision since picking Brady over Bledsoe, which was picking Garrard over Leftwich. And it worked fabulously.
If you had to bet on any team winning 13 games, who would it be?
San Diego.
Yeah, that's probably the pick. That's a bad division.
Because it's because the regular season is different from the playoffs.
We really need to
don't get to play Oakland in the playoffs.
Well, they need to change these divisions. I bitch about this every year.
It's cyclical.
I know, but
the only reason I have a problem with it is because of what happened last year with the Cardinals, and I know that people are going to get angry at me for mentioning what happened last year with the Cardinals.
Well, you're bitter about it.
But the Bears and Tampa Bay have the same record, and it's not fair if you're going to have 14 divisions that if they're going to be this, you know, uneven, that teams like Chicago and Tampa Bay don't get to make the playoffs and get their shot the same way Arizona got their shot.
Just go to 14 playoff teams. For God's sakes, we could have six playoff games that first weekend.
The problem is, I mean, if 14, why not 16?
Well, then 16, you really could get like some sort of lousy team in. 14, I would just love Saturday, two afternoon games, night game. Sunday, two afternoon games, night game. What would be better than that? Just as a fan, I want it. You're not with me?
Well, I mean, I do think that the NFL has the perfect number of playoff teams. You can't bumble your way in at 500 like you can in the NBA and the NHL. But it's a little bit more open than the baseball is.
Well, I'm selfish and I'm all for me. Is there anything you
Well, if you're selfish and you're all for you, then who cares? Because the Patriots are going to make the playoffs almost every year anyway. So
yeah, it is true. Although I do think – I do like Rex Ryan. And I don't know if he'll make his – his impact this year or next year, but I do think at some point the Jets will be heard from.
I'll agree with you. I just think it's more likely to be next year than this
year.
Yeah,
it'll probably be next year, even 2011, but at some point he's going to build something.
The fact is if Mark Sanchez does have a future as a great NFL quarterback, the lack of experience from college, even if it doesn't hinder him permanently, it should at least probably hinder him short term. Because he really is inexperienced.
Right. Who are you guys thinking for the offensive rookie this year that's going to surprise people?
Well, that's going to surprise people?
Well, not surprise people, but the guy who is going to make this season his season.
Well, geez, it was supposed to be Michael Crabtree, but somebody told him not to show up to camp.
Mm. Yeah, that wasn't a good idea.
So that was not really a good decision on, you know, whoever told him that probably. To be honest, nobody really stands out. The most likely would be Sean Moreno just because of opportunity, but I don't think Denver's going to win a lot of games.
I like the kid in the Colts.
LaRon McCoy, maybe? LaShawn McCoy, what's his name from Philly if Westbrook has a major injury?
What about the kid in the Colts, Brown? Could see him doing it.
Because he has to share with a die, and they are going to share.
Yeah, but a die gets hurt every year.
Yeah, but not for the whole year.
I don't know. I have a feeling about this Brown kid. It bugs me. I kind of
wanted
the Pats to get him.
It was clearly Crabtree. Whatever he would get more in contract, he's blown it by blowing the endorsement dollars that would have come with being Rookie of the Year. I just think he's gotten terrible advice.
You know what it is? There has to be one rookie every year who does this. It's just a little rule that we don't know about.
There's two.
Oh, the guy on Cincy?
Yeah.
With the guy with breasts? Yeah, if
but
you have breasts, you shouldn't
hold out. He wasn't going to be Rookie of the Year, and he wasn't going to get endorsement dollars. It's rare for a guy to come into the league as a rookie and be the clear number one receiver on his team. There was so much opportunity there.
You guys need to figure out the effects of Hard Knocks on the NFL season. Has it ever worked out? Has Hard Knocks ever worked out for a team?
No, and if I ran a team, there's no way.
No way in hell. No. Why would you do it? All you have cameras around constantly. They're in coaches' meetings as you're evaluating players. What is the upside?
There's no upside.
So your Super Bowl pick is New England against Chicago?
Oh, no. My Super Bowl pick, subjectively, based on what I would think would happen in the playoffs once every team gets in based on the numbers, would be New England versus the Giants in a rematch.
Oh, my God. That would be unbelievable. I don't know if I'm ready for that.
I don't know if I'm ready for it either. But I do think Chicago. Tell you what, I think there's a really good chance that we have a rematch Super Bowl, but it also could be Indianapolis-Chicago.
Ooh, that would be interesting. At some point, Indy's got to drop off. How long can this continue?
Heck, it could be Pittsburgh-Seattle.
Oh,
I just don't think that's as likely as the other two.
Let's hope we get better officiating if that's the game this time.
that's true. But no, I think I think that it's I really Patriots, Giants, or Bears, Colts are pretty likely Super Bowls. I think.
As a Pats fan, what revenge game would you want more? New England, Chicago, or New England Giants?
Giants, because when New England lost to Chicago, I was 11 and I lived in Michigan, California.
I would want the Bears. I need to avenge that SI cover with Superman on the cover and all the Bears exulting as the Patriots were just strewn about like dead soldiers.
Yeah, I rooted for the Rams when that happened, so I don't really feel need to. I don't feel quite
okay.
The same need.
Well, I need revenge in the Bears. I just have a feeling about the Bears, and maybe they're going to become too bandwagony, but the fact that they finally have a competent quarterback. I mean, you wrote in the book that their last quarterback that you could really call competent was Eric Kramer.
You could probably call Jim Miller competent.
Did he ever play 16 games?
Once. Was the season they made the playoffs. No one.
I was not a big Jim Miller fan.
But no,
that's,
I mean, the
stretch.
Last time they had a top 10 quarterback was Eric Kramer.
And nobody was bouncing their kids in their lap telling them about the time they went to see Eric Kramer.
No. Nobody.
I just think that the fans are going to be so excited to have a real quarterback that somehow that excitement is going to transfer to the season in some sort of strange way.
I mean, their special teams should be great again. Their defense should be better than it was last year. Their offense should be a lot better than it was. I mean, not necessarily good, but even average would be a nice improvement. Forte, lots of talent there. Hester actually learned how to run routes last year, which was really impressive. He's not just a speed guy. Cutler is a massive upgraded quarterback.
They're going to be good,
but the Giants are going to be good too. They've got so much depth now in their front seven that if they had the same kind of injuries they had last year, that they could take them.
Quick plug for your book. I always enjoy it every year, but for some reason my favorite thing is the statistical appendix in the back where you have like the top 20 players in passes, defense, and all that stuff. I love that stuff. I don't know why, but I just find it riveting.
Well, thank you very much. We like putting that in, and I try to put in a lot of that because they're fun, and they're also good for, like, beat reporters to talk about, you know, when a player from the team is high up on, you know, first downs allowed by defensive backs or something.
But these are great stats. Like, Aaron Campman, 20 quarterback hits last year. I need to know things like that.
Yeah, he ain't going to have that this year playing outside linebacker in that 4-3. It's going to be a little different for him.
Yeah, I'm a little worried
about
that.
But, no, listen, that's one of the reasons why we love tracking these stats, that the quarterback hits are in the play-by-play, but people don't really see them because they were just added a couple years ago. But then there's all the things that we track that other people don't, like the quarterback hurries, like the defensive coverage stuff. A couple other people track that. But, you know, you'll see a number of hurries for a player in the middle of a game, and then it, like, disappears into the ether when the game's over. It's like, where does that number go? So, you know, we count it and actually try to show you. Sometimes you'll have a guy like Dwight Freeney a couple years ago when he had a down year in sacks. He still had tons of hits and hurries. There was nothing wrong with Dwight Freeney. He just didn't quite make it all the way to the quarterback as much as usual.
Yeah, he led the league in hurries last year with 28.
I mean, you know, you see Dwight Freeney coming towards you and you freak out.
I mean, it's nice because a lot of times it confirms what you think anyway. Like the top five in hurries is Freeney, Allen, Peppers, Cole, and Williams. Like you would have guessed it would at least like three or four of those guys would be in there. What I thought was interesting, or one of the things I thought was that, like, you count QB knockdowns, which is sacks plus hits. So the guy who led in this stat, it would have taken me 15 guesses. It was Gerard. That's not a team that was, like, winging it every down, you know?
You mean the quarterback who was knocked down the most?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, but their two starting guards went out in the first week of the season.
Right.
I mean,
but I'm just saying, I wouldn't.
They were pulling grandmas out of the stands and putting them in on the offensive line by the end of the year. So.
But I mean, just like seeing that and seeing that only two guys had more than 100, he had 110, and the offensive season that he had, and then you remember, oh yeah, they didn't have an offensive line last year, and oh yeah, their number one receiver was busted for drug possession again right after.
You also
right
see
after
that
the year.
Is Warner second, right?
Yep.
And you realize how much he gets smacked around, and you do start to wonder about him making it through 16 games at age 38.
Well, then
hits the ground a lot.
And then it kind of surprised me that Castle was third.
Yeah, a lot of that is the first half of the year when he had no pocket presence whatsoever.
But when you think, like, he didn't even play the first half of the first game.
Yeah, but that's not that much compared
to... No, I know, but it's just to be third over Jason Campbell, who it seemed like was getting hit constantly.
I think Bill James once said that the an advanced stat is useful when 80% of the results are exactly what you expect and 20% are surprising or something. Hmm. I mean, it, you know, if half the results were surprising, it would probably be wrong. It should agree with what you think, who you think the best pass rushers are, or else you probably really aren't counting pass rushers. But then it's also useful to find out when certain, like, I don't remember if it was last year or the year before that Brian Robinson, I think is his name. He's a defensive end for, or am I thinking of Robert Gethers from Cincinnati? Some guy from Cincinnati was really high in hits and hurries, and I was, you know, nobody thinks of them as having a pass rush.
Right.
But this one guy was doing pretty well. I think it was Robert Gethers.
Another stat I love is quarterback accuracy. Always
yeah, we should do more with that one, with looking at the throws that are not marked as overthrown or underthrown. And it's interesting sometimes to see exactly what happens with the overthrown and the underthrown with specific combinations because, like, for example, Ronald Curry had this awful year last year for Oakland, but he had an amazing number of passes to him that were marked as thrown behind or thrown ahead. Like, you know, that Russell could not hit him in stride. So you would think better quarterback. I mean, who knows if Matthew Stafford counts as better quarterback. Well, I'm sorry, he's with the Rams now. Mark Bulger does count as better quarterback. So you think better quarterback, better year for this guy.
Breeze,
you can learn to hit the slot receiver in stride.
Breeze, Manning, Favre. Surprised to see Favre third, but that was your 1-2-3. The bottom of the list was exactly what you think it would be. JT O'Sullivan, Derek Anderson, Darren Orlovsky. One shocker, Matt Hasselbeck, but maybe not really a shocker.
Well, yeah, that Matt was, he was so injured with the offensive line. The thing about Favre, if you think about Favre interceptions, most Favre interceptions are not because he throws the ball and it ends up nowhere near the receiver.
Yeah.
They're because he throws the ball where the receiver has about 2 inches of space and there's six defenders there.
Your last guy on the list, Mr. Jamarcus Russell. 73.5% of his passes were accurate, which means 26.5% were not. That's not good.
He's not, listen, there's never been a quarterback over the last 15 years who has been below replacement value in our numbers their first 2 years and developed into a good NFL starter.
Then you have, I enjoyed the yards from pass interference, which I have always felt should count for fantasy. Phil Rivers had seven passes for 143 yards of pass interference. I should get those yards.
Bernard Berrien was the king of that last year.
And then you had the top 20 passes dropped. No big shocker, Braylon Edwards leading the list.
Yeah, but you know this, Mercedes Lewis. Remember I talked about Garrard?
Yeah.
And the Mercedes Lewis, a tight end, dropped like 8 or 9 passes last year. How did a tight end drop like 9 passes?
What do you make of this, the top 20 first downs, touchdowns allowed in coverage? Charles Tillman was first. I mean, is that, sometimes people just target one cornerback so that can,
well, part
stats,
of that,
right?
Is also that he, you know, I think that, he was also really, yeah, he was really high in targets, but they switched from the cover two last year to playing more man or cover three, and then he didn't have Vasher on the other side. The Bears' defense was a little bit of a mess in the secondary last year.
Top 20 yards after catch allowed. I love the stat.
By defensive backs,
and Griffin.
Although there's some linebackers in there, like if you were covering a guy on like a short cross or something, and
how did you figure out top 20 passing yards allowed in coverage? That must have been difficult.
Well, the game charters mark the players that appear to be in coverage. Now, it's not perfect because we're working off TV film, but we do the best we can. Sometimes they'll mark a hole in zone or they'll mark two guys, but we try to, you know, get the coverage. And then we look at the yards allowed. We looked at the success allowed because you have to look at both yards allowed and success allowed because particularly a lot of zone defense are based on the idea that you should be giving up 5-yard passes on 2nd and 10, or, you know, you're fine to give up the 8 yards on the 3rd and 10. So like a guy like Kelvin Hayden or something from Indianapolis will end up giving up a lot more yards than the success rate because the Colts, you know, defense was always based on the idea of, you know, sure, let them have the 4-yard pass on 2nd and 10.
Another classic, most dropped interceptions, 2007, 2008. Ike Taylor and Collins, I can't remember who
that
is.
From Green Bay. That
Nick
is
Collins?
The Ike Taylor stat, by the way.
Yeah.
But dropped interceptions are so rare that to come up with a list with any kind of reasonable meaningfulness, I had to use 2 years, and even that is probably not that statistically significant.
I still love it. And in fact,
it is the Ike Taylor list, though. It is totally the Ike Taylor list.
Well, don't think I didn't expect to see Asante Samuel on there, and there he was.
It doesn't include
he was in second place with 6
Super Bowls.
Yeah, but he still was there. Jesus. Brought back some flashbacks. All right, Aaron Schatz, we will read you on footballoutsiders.com this year. You're coming back in the BS Report during the season. You can buy your book on Amazon.com, on your website. You can buy the PDF file. I urge everybody to get it.
Should definitely point out to people that we're not in bookstores this year because of the self-publishing. So you have to either go to Amazon or to our site, and you can either get a regular printed book or a PDF-only computer file that's about half the cost.
It's worth it. If you're a football fan, you got to do it.
Well,
in my opinion.
The PDF is like $12 for 550 pages. Golly, I hope that's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, that's just think of the gambling ramifications. That could swing, you know, $1,000 worth of bets.
I remind you to only think of the gambling ramifications if you live in Nevada or Canada.
All right, we'll talk to you during the season. Thanks, man. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we're going to call our friend Mike Lombardi from the National Football Post really quick because he pursued a project that we discussed on the BS Report about trying to figure out exactly who were the blue chippers in the NFL. He spent the last 2.5 weeks doing it. And just checking in with him right
now.
Hello. Hey, what's happening?
Hey, you're making the calls. What happened to Joe Mead?
He's there. I was doing my intro as we called you. I just set you up. So explain to America the blue project that you've been doing in the NationalFootballPost.com for the last couple weeks.
Okay, well, here's what's happened. I had a great conversation with you. You suggested that we come up with a blue system, which is a little hard to do, and let me kind of go into it. When I was at the Raiders, I went over to Cal and spent a day trying to statistically analyze situations and rankings. And what the guy told me, the stat professor, which is way smarter than me, was you got to put people into groups, and you can't go 1 through 32. You have to kind of, because 1 to 2 is too hard to define. So if you can put people in groups, you have a better system. So we try to make a blue system to where we have a category of players that are what we call blue players, top 10 at their positions in the NFL, and then a category that are almost blues, players that are looking to almost get there, that achieve there, that are close, but quite haven't made it, whether it's production, age, durability, some other reason that keeps them from being a blue player. And then once we've rated those players, blues and almost blues, along with the head coach being a blue, we'll only give a score if a coach is a blue, then we'll total them up and have our power rankings at the end of the year.
And the reason I was interested in you pursuing this is because I think it's a really good indicator of whether a team is either just a juggernaut or whether a team might potentially be better than we think they are. And for instance, like a team like Houston had more blues and almost blues than I kind of was prepared for.
Right. They have a lot of talent, but sometimes, and then we have to value the blues because sometimes you could have a lot of blues, but not in the right position.
Right.
And then it's harder to win games. And if you have a blue coach and a blue quarterback, maybe that's the recipe to winning football games. So the common denominator, I really believe this, and I was just talking to a GM in the league, and he's been reading it and following it, is we both believe that when this is done, it'll pretty much be the good teams in the league will fall pretty much in order.
Right. And the reason I like it is because a lot of times, especially like when you're talking about like the offensive line, defensive line, positions like that, I'm not really sure who the top 8 guys or the top 7 guys are. So I appreciate that. I also like that, you know, you made your initial list. You got feedback from readers. You got feedback from executives and your friends, stuff like that. It's like a work in progress. You're tinkering with it. I like that you approach it that way.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, whenever you're trying to do something, you got to collect all the information. And the one rule of scouting that is critical is never begin with the end in mind. And so therefore, that allows you to take information in from other factors without having your conclusions already reached. And in personnel, you have to be very willing to take new information as it comes in. And you got to be open-minded. When you're dealing with over 1,700 names, you're not going to be able to get everybody pristinely correct.
And as a member of the advisory board on the Blue Chip Committee and founding co-CEO, I sent you an email today demanding a couple changes, I appreciated that you accepted them.
Because it's your idea, I value your opinion, and I think that when you feel as strongly as you do about something, I think I have to reconsider it, and certainly I'm going to readjust it, because before I put the power ranking on the page, I want to make sure it's perfectly correct.
I couldn't accept Carson Palmer. I just feel like he has not been healthy in 3 years. I don't see how he's a blue chipper.
Well,
I know on paper he might be, but I need to see it again from him. I can't give him blue chip status.
Well, it's funny, and I'm not saying this because you brought his name up, but yesterday when I was re-ranking him and I came up with my final list, I almost moved him down because I really only wanted 10 quarterbacks on the list. But I kind of gave him the 2005 season played in my head, and I kind of gave him the benefit of the doubt. And that's where people have really done a nice job of calling me out and basically saying, look, you know, you say this guy's Walter Jones is not durable, but he's still a good player, but you didn't let Woodson on the list because of his durability. That's kind of what you need. You need to have some checks and balances of your own thought process because there are a lot of inconsistencies, and that's what makes Belichick such a great guy in the draft room because he has a unique ability to make sure that everything stays consistent.
And I asked you to please remove Brandon Marshall as quickly as possible because he's an insane person. You can't be insane and have blue chip status. I don't know if he's going to show up for Sunday's game.
Well, one thing about Brandon Marshall, when the games start, he's blue. And Monday, like a little bit like a couple players that I've had on my teams, Monday through Saturday, they drive you crazy. But on Sunday, boy, they're really good players. And he's a guy that, for me, he's a top five receiver, not a top 10 receiver. He's a top five receiver in terms of talent. And I think a lot of this is being blown out of proportion. Today it's come out that he's moved out of scout team. I think McDaniels is doing the Belichickian program to Marshall, and I think by the middle of the season I'll have him turned around.
I agree that he's a top five talent. My question is, does he need to be on a specific type of team to reach that talent? And I think what we've seen the last couple of years is that if he's not in a great situation or if he's unhappy for whatever reason, it just completely sidetracks him. And for a blue chipper, I want a guy that I can count on. I want a guy who's a sure thing. Like, to me, Reggie Wayne, that's a blue chipper. That guy is going to show up. He's going to play 16 games. He's going to come through. You can throw to him. He's going to have to be double teamed. I don't feel like Brandon Marshall. I don't trust him. You know what I mean? That's my take with him.
Yeah, and I watched him enough being there in 2007 that I thought that the guy had such, and he practiced hard. He likes football. When you get him there, it's the off the field stuff that has always kept him from really being the highest paid receiver in the league or in the top five because he's been in front of the Commissioner Goodell's office way too much. And, you know, that does worry, and that's why his value in terms of trade. What you're saying is the same thing most NFL teams are trading. We're talking about when all this talk about trading for Brandon Marshall, nobody trusts him enough to give up a lot of draft picks for him, and so Denver can't trade him because they can't get really what his value is. So
yes.
What you're saying essentially is exactly what the NFL is saying about Brandon Marshall.
Yeah, and this is another guy you had on there that I just didn't – I don't think he's ready yet, Owen Daniels. I agree that he might get there, but two touchdowns last year, you got to be able to get in the end zone more than that to be my blue-chip tight end. But more importantly than that, you know, you only had eight cornerbacks listed on your initial list, which – it just was hard for me to believe that in a 32-team league, there are only eight blue-chip cornerbacks, but you left out Asante Samuel. Well, why did you leave out Samuel? What was the reasoning?
Because I really believe Samuel's always linked to the – to me, you don't go into a game saying, oh, I'm not going after Asante Samuel. I'm not even going over on that side. Forget about it. Asante Samuel is one of the great guessers of our time. He's good at what he does. He was Dre Bly before Dre Bly. He's
right.
Very good at guessing routes. Anticipating, he reads quarterbacks well, and when the pass rush is prevalent, he's sensational. When the pass rush isn't so good, he's just kind of okay. Not bad, but not great. And that's why I kind of left him off. And I have a real hard time, and this is a pet peeve of mine. I always believe cornerbacks play are directly linked to pass rush. And I know you need great corners to win in the NFL, but I think you need a great pass rush first and foremost.
Well, the other guy you left off that I protested was Chris Gamble in Carolina. Now, if Houston offered Owen Daniels for either of those guys, both teams say no. Right?
You're probably right. Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to look at it. I think you're right on that. I think, you know, Owen Daniels is unique because, to me, he has a lot of skill. Every time I see him, he never drops a pass. It's like, to me, Jason Witten. Whenever the ball's thrown in Jason Witten's direction, you know, and I'm sure somebody's seen him drop the ball. I've seen him drop one, but rarely do you ever think he's not going to catch the ball. And that's the way I view Owen Daniel. He's tough to match up with because corners can't get to him, and little safeties can't handle him, and big safeties can't run with him, and they can still run the ball effectively with him in the game.
And the other guy you left off, and by the way, on Daniels, I think he will be a blue by the end of the season. I just need to see it from him. I can't give you blue status based on I think you're going to get to this point. How about getting to this point, and then I'll give you the blue status. But the other guy he left off was Campman, which I was kind of shocked by what was the reasoning there.
Well, I like Aaron Campman. I think the best defensive lineman was Colin Jenkins, and I put him as blue. I think Colin Jenkins is one of the best unkept secrets in the National Football League. I think he's really good. I think Campman's, I had him as almost blue. I think he's really good. I think there's some tackles that he has hard times with. I think the 34 defense will really help him. People think it's going to hurt him, but I think he'll get better matchups than that. I mean, I couldn't argue completely against Campman. I think I had 10 defensive ends already on the list. That's why I put him down almost blue. I'm an Aaron Campman fan.
On the Football Outsiders, in their book, he was third for combo sacks and hits, 31. I feel like
player.
He's got to be on there.
There's a lot of Green Bay Packers fans that agree with you. And they were strong on Charles Woodson. And, you know, I had to come back to him on Woodson. And I thought he was just had a bad year. But I agree. Charles Woodson belonged on the list.
So you came up with a point system that you're going to try to figure out exactly who has the most points. And I like how you did it. My idea was that you should just do 10 for a blue chip, 5 for an almost blue chip. But you're actually going to weight it a little more because some positions are more valuable than others. Like if you have a blue chip quarterback, that's better than having a blue chip tight end.
Right. And where I learned this was when we first got introduced to the salary cap, we all took our contracts from previous years and put them into the cap. And what we learned was, having a middle linebacker who was one of your highest paid players and was a good player didn't translate into winning on the field. He ate too much cap room up. So there has to be a value placed on the position. Much like in the first round, you shouldn't pick somebody in the top 12 that cannot impact the game on third down, either keeping a player off the field or getting to the quarterback. So that's where you have to be very diligent, and you have to have the right positions. You can have a lot of blues, but if they're at the wrong spot, they may not help you win.
What 2009 rookies who you could not put on the list because they were ineligible, correct?
Yes.
2009 rookies. So which, if you had to pick three that will definitely be on this list when you do your midseason blue chip list, who would it be? Who would they be?
Well, I think no Sean Moreno, when he's healthy, is going to be a blue player. I think he's got great skill. I think he's in the right system. I think he's got all the attributes to really flourish in that scheme. I think he's really going to be a good player. Let's see here. I think Michael Orr will eventually become a blue because I think he really shows in the first couple preseason games that he has it. I think Vontae Davis, the corner from Miami in the first couple preseason games that I've watched, he's been very effective as a cover guy. And he's always been a blue-type athlete. He's always been a blue-type player. He not necessarily has always had the blue production. And then
right.
I think Kenny Britt has really flashed this offseason in terms of what he's done with the Titans. I think he's got a chance to be a blue receiver. I think the Giants probably sat there and debated Hicks, Nix, or Britt, and I think they might have picked the wrong one.
What about the kid on Minnesota? I keep hearing people buzzing about him.
Percy Harvin is a really good player. He's kind of a slot receiver. He's going to be an all-purpose player. I think he really has a tremendous amount of skills, and he's very good with the ball in his hands. The Minnesota offense, to me, is a work in progress. I want to see how they're going to get him the football.
Do you think Brad Childress is a work in progress?
I think he's a complete work in progress. And I thought of you the other day because I loved it. I was watching the Vikings game, and he challenged the play in the preseason. And because the two guys in the booth are both paid by Minnesota, they completely agreed with the challenge. But unfortunately, the referee didn't agree with the challenge and overturned him. And he's already keeping his streak together. You know, now Brad's got the Michael I don't know. I think it's the Madonna headpiece, maybe where, you know, it's not over his head. It's just in his ear so he can move around.
Yeah.
Looking pretty good. Yeah, looking pretty shazzy.
Well, you know, we lost some terrible coaches over the offseason, and it's really up to Brad to carry the torch, I think. I don't really know. Like, if you had to make a top.
We have Dick Curl back in St. Louis. Even though he's not a head coach, it's good to know that the game management of the St. Louis Rams is being handled by Dick.
Literally and figuratively. Brad Childress, I think, clearly the number one worst coach heading, like the number one coach who can really do the most damage with a potential playoff team, unless you want to throw North Turner in there. But, you know, I don't know.
North won some playoff games. I mean,
yeah.
North gets his bad rap. I mean, conference championship game 2 years ago against New England, loses his best running back last year without his best running back. Now, I understand Herm Edwards and Dick Curl allowed Norv to go by calling timeouts in the Kansas City game. I know that helped them. So I say that, but Norv won another playoff game for the Chargers. I mean, Norv, everybody keeps piling on Norv, but Norv keeps winning playoff games, and at some point, that's important.
Have you been watching Hard Knocks?
I've been watching Hard Knocks, enjoying it tremendously, and there's so much to discuss about Hard Knocks.
Well, let's hear it.
Well, you know, for example, you know, you're a New England Patriot fan. I'm a Bill Belichick fan. I root for the Patriots. But, you know, when you see those conversations between the head coach and the assistant coach, and the head coach goes over to him and says, hey, this is, what are you thinking about this? And, you know, this guy should make the team or that. That conversation really doesn't happen in New England. There's one guy running that operation, you know, and he's coming over to the assistant coach to delegate what he wants from him, not the coach telling him. So there's a little paradigm shift there, and I think that that's kind of funny to see. I kind of thought it was funny. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what about the part where, and maybe I was in denial and didn't really realize this happened, but what about Mike Brown, who, as far as I could tell, has really no pro football credentials at all? He's the guy who decides, like, what's going to happen with the roster.
Well, that was, you know, that I lived that. I mean, you know, he's an owner of the team. When you're the owner of the team, you know, I mean, that did not surprise me. I mean, because I've been in the NFL, and I know that Mike Brown runs the team. It's a family-run operation, and he's got final say. And when he called them all together, I kind of thought it was ironic how it was set up. Mike at the head of the class, all the other students, including Marvin, were sitting over on the other side.
Well, but that's what shocked me, though. I mean, I knew he was the owner. I knew he had some say. I didn't realize he was, like, basically telling everybody how this was going to play out, and that the coach and whoever the GM is, I guess he's the GM. I don't even know. But everybody was bunched together, as you said, like kids in a classroom. Hey, here's what we're going to do, fellas. It was like nobody had any say. I was stunned.
No. Well, he owns the team, and that's, you know, that happens more than you think in the NFL. I mean, he owns the team, and he's going to control the team, and he's never – people say Mike Brown should hire a general manager. That means he would have to fire himself. He controls the play. He controls it, and he runs it, and that's, you know, that's the right that he has because he's one of the 32 owners, so he can do it.
Plus, he'd lose out on the GM bonus that he gives himself.
I'm sure he's well compensated, you know, and I think that, you know, with that viewpoint of how things go, I think this is a really good Hard Knocks this year, by the way.
Me too.
I think it's really good. I think it's enlightening. I watch it. It's not as phony as it's been in the past. I think it's really good, but, you know, I think it's enlightening to see how the Bengals run their operation, and I think that, you know, obviously it's a family-run business. It truly is. It's family-run.
Speaking of family-run businesses, your old team, the Oakland Raiders,
yes,
got in a little hot water with arguably the weirdest locker room incident, I guess you'd call it, or whatever. The weirdest incident of this decade, an assistant coach getting allegedly, reportedly punched by the head coach.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because the one thing we do know that's factual is that Randy Hansen had to go to the hospital. Now, I've not seen the medical report. It's been reported to us at the National Football Post that he's got a broken cheekbone. We've not seen the medical reports. That's been told to us. So something happened in that meeting between Tom Cable, Randy Hansen, and three other assistant coaches that only time is going to give us the true answer. And maybe, you know, having to testify under oath is really going to give us the true answer, because when Randy Hansen pressed charges or filed the complaint or filed the report, that's going to lead to other things down the road.
And this basically murders, not that the Raiders season was going to be anything special anyway, but this is too big of a distraction, right?
Well, you know, at the Raiders, distractions are part of life. You know, it's not really that difficult to handle. Every day is a distraction at the Raiders because, you know, the players are always looking around, because if you think Mike Brown's running the Bengals, you should see how the Raiders are run.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know if it really – I think people say that, but I think the Raiders are very comfortable in dysfunction.
You are the only person I know who really makes a concerted effort to watch every preseason game, or as many as you possibly can. Has anything jumped out at you these first 2 weeks?
I think Denver's a lot better than people think they are.
Me too!
I think Denver could be really a lot better because I think they're really well coached. And if they can rush the passer, and if they get a lead, I think they can be really, really good.
So you're not worried about Kyle Orton just completely murdering them by himself?
I think they'll prevent themselves from Kyle Orton. I think he's, you know, the one thing about quarterbacks, people talk about the quarterback, the coaches have to learn what the quarterback is too.
Yeah.
So I think they're learning what Kyle Orton can and can't do. And I think they're going to call a little bit more, especially in the red zone. I think they may call more runs and screens than they would call downfield throws.
What's interesting about them, let's say Brandon Marshall does kind of get it together. I think Eddie Royal is going to make a giant leap this year, especially in that offense. And I don't know why he's not being mentioned with some of these fantasy receivers, like in that third, fourth round range. I just think he's going to have a monster year. If they get anything from Moreno, now you're talking about three guys that defenses have to plan for every week, right?
Right. And an offensive line that can protect, and a system of offense that is so creative, and they have so many plays that they can get to everything that they need to.
And
so I think they're really good. I think they'll play San Diego late in the season in a meaningful game.
Well, we knew that somebody out of one of the two West divisions was going to surprise people, and it does seem like everybody keeps looking at the NFC West. We just talked about it with Aaron Schatz about it, but it does seem like either the Chiefs or the Broncos, one of those teams at least goes 9-7 and possibly is sniffing around week 15, week 16 for a wild card spot, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that Denver, I think it's Denver. I think Denver has more going for them because Denver's offensive line is structured. Kansas City's offensive line is a work in progress.
And don't discount the Ewing theory potential of not having Jay Cutler and Mike Shanahan, who really haven't done anything for this entire decade.
Yeah, well, I think that they have a lot to prove. I think McDaniels, when he gets in front of that team, I think he's won that team over. And I don't think it's like when Belichick was in Cleveland. You know, the team, you know, the owner may not have bought that Bill was enticing the team, but he won that. The team listened to him. And as I used to say to the owner at that time, his audience isn't the 3 million people in Northeast Ohio. It's the 60 in the room. And that's what I think McDaniels has won.
Is there an NFC team that is better than you thought they'd be at this point?
I think Green Bay is really good. I think Green Bay is going to be tough to play. I think they're good. I think the scheme change with Dom Capers helps them. I think they got, if they stay healthy, I think they can be really a very effective team. I think Atlanta, I think Matt Ryan, I keep thinking that Matt Ryan and Atlanta are going to have the little funk, but I think Matt Ryan's really good. He was really good, and I was darn tempted to make him a Blue. I just think the guy has a veteran quality to him that's unique. And I think he can be something special. I don't know if they're going to have the pitfalls that I thought they might have.
Well, why can't you give him the Carson Palmer spot?
I could have given him that spot. I just kind of wanted to wait till halfway. I wanted to use your Owen Daniel halfway through the year before I did it. You know, I did
right.
that for him, and I didn't do it for Owen Daniel. So there's
That's
a little
fair.
Inconsistency there. But I think they're really a very good team. And I think he's sensational. I think the Tony Gonzalez trade really is really what's going to make them very good. So I like them, and I'm not sure what to think of New Orleans yet. I'm not sure what to think of some of the other teams of Carolina and the AFC, and you know the other teams in the NFC South haven't really distinguished themselves to me to think that they're better than Atlanta.
Are you even remotely intrigued by Vic on the Eagles, or you think he does nothing this year?
I am intrigued, but I think he only does something if they let him run the offense. I think Michael Vick has to be the sixth man in basketball. I think he has to come in and he has to play quarterback under center and give Donovan McNabb a break, maybe some wildcat stuff, certainly 8 to 12 plays. I think he's the, you know, for lack of a better term, the Bobby Jones of the 76ers, the sixth man. He comes in off the field, he runs some plays, he does some things, he tires the defensive line out, which is critical. And then Donovan comes back into a tired defensive line that can't rush very well and then starts to throw the game and make plays. So I think if he's used in the correct vein, I think he can be very effective. But I don't think he comes in and just runs. You know, I see on TV people have all these design trick plays. Well, football's not a sandlot game. It's an intellectual game. You got to have precision when you run your offense.
Well, the one thing that will be really interesting is – if they just bring him in on third and ones and third and shorts and stuff, because they were terrible in those situations last year. Do you think that they could realistically just bring him in on every third and one?
Well, I think they definitely could, because I think they'll definitely get a softer edge. I think they'll be scared to death because they have to do something. They have no tight end on the team that can block, and they still haven't unraveled the Sean Andrews dilemma. So they have no power with their football team. Now, they're hoping Leonard Weaver gives them a little bit more power, but so far it hasn't affected them in the preseason. It hasn't showed up. So I agree. I think in the red area, remember in the red area, to get the ball in the end zone, oftentimes because people play coverage down there and the space of the field has shrunk, it's harder to throw the ball into the end zone for touchdowns. So running the ball is where you really need to do it down there, and that's where Vic can make a difference.
Well, one of my favorite, or one of your favorite theories of mine, the VP of Common Sense, you always want to do things that the other team doesn't want you to do, correct? So if I'm the other team, and Michael Vick comes in on third and short at the 22-yard line, I'm freaking terrified. I don't know what's going to happen. And plus, my defensive lineman front seven, I'm so used to McNabb's got me in this certain rhythm. And then all of a sudden, this athletic freak comes in the game and is capable of really running either direction, doing anything he wants. You have to plan for that. Your defense, you have to spend extra time during the week preparing for it. I think it's going to be significant. I really do.
I think if they use them correctly, it really can make a big difference to their whole team. And you know, preparation is so much a part of football, and you can't prepare for the speed of Michael Vick in your practices. And that's always was a problem, and I think it's still going to be a problem when he comes out. So I am curious about Michael Vick. I'm curious about how it's all going to play out.
We're going to talk to you the week of week one, but right now, heading into week three, preseason, Super Bowl matchup, who would you pick?
I would. Somebody asked me that last night. I'm going to go New England, Green Bay.
I would go New England, Chicago right now, but I'm willing to be talked out of it.
You know, and I think Chicago the other night against the Giants, their defensive line showed up and they played really well, and that's what they're going to need. They're going to need that kind of intensity. I think Chicago's a very appealing team. I think they're better at receiver than people think they are. Because they don't recognize the names. That's why nobody thinks they're good. So, you know, I think Chicago's going to be a tough team to play. I think the Giants, you know, I think the best thing that's happened to the Giants is things haven't been easy this summer. And I think Tom Coughlin will always take that lack of making it easy and build it into a strength. And they could still be there at the end. But I like Green Bay's team. I think Aaron Rodgers in the second year is going to be very good. And I think they can rush the passer. And I think they can get enough points on people that they can play a lot of those funky coverages that Dom Capers runs, and it's hard for quarterbacks to prepare for.
I agree. I like Chicago and Green Bay the most out of anybody in that conference. Here's my question for Chicago, though. 3rd and 9, December 2nd, or let's say like week 14 or whatever, cold weather. They're down 4, 3.5 minutes left. Who does Cutler throw to?
You know, I probably tries to run an option route with Matt Forte because he's still going to be the best player, or Greg Myers is going to get the ball. The one thing the Bears have, they're a little bit diversified with their tight ends. Desmond Clark can block, and Greg Olsen, I called him Greg Myers, Greg Olsen can go out and flex out, and he can win a lot of matchups outside. He's like a wide receiver, but he can block a little bit better.
So I think the middle of the field
with Forte and Olsen, I think those guys are going to be the factor.
Interesting. So you're counting on Greg Olsen. That's your swing guy for... Because you know football. There's 4 or 5 plays per season that come down to, I need somebody to go make this play on 3rd and 9 or 3rd and 11, 3rd and 8, whatever. And that was the thing they didn't have last year.
Right. And they got to have it, and it's got to be in the middle of the field, because as the wind increases in Soldier Field and the wind increases in Green Bay and it increases, and when you're outside, you want to make throws in the middle of the field that are a lot easier. And if you can have a back who can run an option route and you have a tight end who can win on third down, you can control the middle of the field.
I do have one prediction for you about the Patriots. Yep. I think they're going to go 17-1. What do you think?
I think they're really good. I think the best thing happened to them is they didn't play good against Cincinnati. I think this week against Washington, you know, I think they'll take it probably a lot more seriously. I think Brady's got a lot of good quality reps, and I think that's what they need as an offense.
Oh, I like our linebackers this year. That's my favorite thing about the team.
I think they have more speed on their football team, and I think Burgess will make a big difference to the rusher. And the fact is they're going to get leads on people, and they're going to play from ahead, and that's going to make them even tougher to deal with.
All right, Mike Lombardi, the Blue Chip Project continues on the NationalFootballPost.com. Actually, NationalFootballPost.com. But so hopefully you have some resolution before the season. Looking forward to reading.
We're going to keep working to it. We're working on it. You got it.
I've really enjoyed it, and I love the way that you've used your readers and used feedback from people. It was the right way to do it.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
All right, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Bye-bye.
So I get to sign off.
Whoa!
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.